Felix.
Yes, sir.
Good to have you, man, on set. We never had this conversation. Most of our conversations have been a bit, you know, on the private side of things.
Yes.
But, you know, I see you as probably a pioneer when it comes to, you know, the virtual asset space. What you've done, not just from the business side, but even in terms of shaping the regulations, you know, which are now in, you know, in progress of being implemented at some point. Maybe for our audience who don't know just about you, how has your journey been in this space, and, you know, how did you start it out?
Yes. It's an interesting one, and thank you for inviting me for the interview. So back in 2018, I was a student at the University of Nairobi School of Medicine. That's the interesting part. It's the case that I was sharing a room with software developers and so on, and I could hear them every day explore fourth industrial revolution technologies. Somewhere down the line, as my interest peaked, I ended up as a researcher at the Institute for Blockchain Studies, which was a New York-based institute. But one thing that stood out for me is that there are no researchers in Africa. So they had researchers in LATAM, Asia, all these other places. From that 1 year of doing research on Ethereum and these assets, I decided now, you know, I had been sold on the technology. And so around 2018, I started working for a node validation company. So node validation simply means you transact on behalf of other people on the network. You run the transactions for the blockchain network. Some people call it mining, but node validation is an appropriate term. So that then showed me the inner workings of blockchains, and I could see the benefits that it has. Back then, I used to be paid in something called EOS, the asset. The question is now, how do I convert this crypto token to local currency where I need to use it? So it brought me, you know, in touch with the exchanges. The earliest exchanges, all of them were peer-to-peer. None of them had big balance sheets. So the likes of Remitano, local bitcoins.
And I remember Paxful.
Paxful, yes. So you could convert... You convert from US to Bitcoin, from Bitcoin to USDT.
And that's the time when we met actually.
I think that's around the time we met.
Yeah.
Yes. So progressively, I was able to appreciate that this problem, we call it on-ramp, off-ramp. But, you know, if you think about a ramp, you're moving from one place down here to another place up there. So when you're talking about digital assets and you're talking about local currencies, digital assets are global in nature. They rest on the internet. Local currencies are local. They are sovereign. They're within a particular jurisdiction. So when you move from local currencies to digital assets, that's on-ramp. And when you move from digital assets to local currencies, that's off-ramp. So on-ramping and off-ramping. So I was able to appreciate this problem is not one that is fully solved in Africa, at least, and that we needed more solutions providers. So around 2020, during COVID, we launched Kotani Pay. Kotani actually means accomplish in Swana. Okay. And our aim was basically to bridge this gap between digital assets and local currencies. So today we are a licensed crypto asset service provider in South Africa. We are live in about 7 African countries. We have been fortunate to do millions, not billions, in volume. But it's because more and more people can see the benefits of transacting on the blockchain. You'll hear a lot of people say transacting on-chain. Mm-hmm. But it's bridged a massive gap when it comes to cross-border payments, fragmented nature of payments in Africa.
Okay, interesting. You know, one of the earliest things that I remember, I think around 2021, 2022, mm-hmm. There was a project by the World Food Programme.
Yes.
Whereby and a bunch of young people doing micro work in Kibera. And you are the first ever person that I saw doing on and off ramp, mm-hmm. whereby they do the micro work, but then how do they convert that money into mobile money? Mm-hmm. Not complicated. You are doing it via USSD at the time.
Yes.
And I mean, just seeing the growth and then up to a point when Kenya had issues to do with the foreign currency.
Yes.
And you guys did a lot of work. I don't want to go into the details.
Yes.
But around helping these institutions that were navigating, think of a supplier in the they're buying things from China or Middle
East. China, yes.
Yes. Places, and they're having challenges accessing dollars.
Yes.
And you guys made that so simple, even for the biggest manufacturers in Kenya. I mean, I'm just curious to know how that journey has been up to the level that you've gotten. And, you know, up to, you know, how you manage now to work with the large institutions, you know, without disclosing the actual names, but, you know, how that journey has been.
Okay. So one of the statements that I appreciate from a gentleman called Mark Andreessen, he's a venture capital partner at Andreessen Horowitz. He was, I think, the first, one of the biggest IPOs in the Ali.com bubble was Mosaic, his company. It was Google Chrome before Google Chrome, right? And he says, if a bad team meets a good market, the market will win. And if a good team, an excellent team, meets a bad market, the market will win. The point there being that the market always wins. Customers will always vote with their feet. People will always go to what is more convenient, what is easy, what, you know, costless. And so when we started initially, because we were not looking at mass market, and businesses really didn't care about these new technologies. NGOs were the ones who are facing the toughest, you know, fees in terms of disbursements. A lot of them, like the World Food Program, for example, were working with cash. Cash handling, cash movement is one of the most expensive things. You can even lose as much as 25% of the total amount doing cash. You know, you have to protect the cars. You have to have security. You have, you know, you have to pay for fuel and whatnot. So for them, they had started exploring, what other forms of technology can we use to send money to somebody in Dadaab, right? So luckily for us, I think some of the blessings we have is because of some of that work we did with those refugees in Dadaab, if you ask me. But it was that they will send us stable coins. They had partnered with the Celo Foundation, which was at the time focused on humanitarian use cases. So, you know, the people in Dadaab were able to create wallets through our technology, were able to create wallets by USSD. So you just key in *483 star something hash, it creates for you a blockchain wallet. You are in Dadaab, you don't have to know it's a blockchain wallet. The guys at World Food Program send the funds, the funds get to your wallet, and then you're able to withdraw to your M-Pesa SIM card. So anybody who had a SIM card could benefit from this technology, right? So that's the first use case that really stood out for us, and we were like, wow, we can actually change people's lives. Because eventually when we did analysis of that particular project, a lot of the women who received these funds ended up setting up businesses within the camp. Somebody would, you know, sell this and that. For the micro work use case, it's also a very interesting one, because you had you know, we had youth in Kibra who could do basically data annotation. We didn't know at the time that we were actually working for OpenAI.
Yes, actually, yes.
We didn't know that it was OpenAI that was training ChatGPT, the LLM, the very popular LLM. But it was the cheapest way that OpenAI could pay workers in Kenya. It's now infamous, it's $2 a day. But at the time, for us, what we're looking at is, can these $2 make a difference in somebody's life? Because when you're working on-chain, you're working the blockchain, the transactions are like micro-cents. You can send $100 million for micro-cents. Like, you know this already, Eric. Slowly by slowly, we started thinking of our go-to-market as expanding beyond that initial market. So whereas we started with the NGOs and small wallets, we continued to expand our vision, and we continued to expand the use cases. And at some point, I remember there's even a slide you said, we would like to serve mainstream financial institutions. We would like to serve banks. But that was way in the future. We met businesses that said, you know, we are facing dollar shortages. We are going to banks. We need dollars. And this was very acute. In 2021 and 2022, this was a major, major problem in the Kenyan economy. I think if you remember at the time, the Kenyan shilling moved from 122 Kenyan shillings to a dollar to 160.
Yeah, 167.
167, or thereabout. And so if you went to the bank would be like, no, for us as KCB, we are prioritizing government.
Yeah.
Because government has to buy oil and medicines and all these things to take care of the populace. Mm. And so at that point is when we started interacting with very big manufacturers, some of the biggest edible oil manufacturers in Kenya.
Remember.
And for them also, it was all about providing them the solution to their problem. I think that was the first time that Kenyan business started taking stablecoins seriously.
Interesting. It's quite interesting that, you know, while you are doing all that work, I tend to think of, from a regulation standpoint, early on, if you remember, we had the likes of BitPesa that tried doing, you know, an actual buying and selling, but not, I mean, not the P2P way, but directly by mobile money. But, you know, they faced challenges with being cut off, central bank at the time sending warnings. And then later they started now becoming more, you know, a bit more active and looking, okay, you know, what could be done? Up to the time, you know, later now, we a lot of people were pushed into the gray area of operating on the P2P side of things. And now, I just think of how times have changed up to the moment now. We are literally discussing how to have the regulations. You know, how would you just think through that moment that we went through as an industry around regulation and, you know, how these regulators were a bit, you know, more aggressive towards fintechs and what has changed? What do you think has changed and, you know, what do you expect in the next future?
Yes. So I think regulation will always be a friction point if you're thinking about innovating. Because innovating means we're doing things differently from how we have traditionally done them. And it's a case to the regulator that they want stability. It's a case that as much as there's change, they don't want a change that will impact many people negatively. So whereas people look at regulators in a negative light, what I've come to learn with them and see with them is that they feel whatever change that's coming, however disruptive it is, it shouldn't have a negative impact on majority of the population. So I think the biggest concern, for example, with AI today is that it will displace a lot of jobs. I think by 2040, they're saying it's going to be, you know, the end of work, essentially. We'll see. We'll see whether we'll see whether we get to that. But for us, there was first a cautionary notice from the central bank.
2015.
Remember? Cautionary notice is not an outright ban, which means is it's like you're told park your car here at your own risk. Kind of situation. So we understood that we were not doing anything illegal. We're just in a gray area where the regulator has basically tried to discourage the buying and selling of cryptocurrencies. But there's nothing illegal about it. If you remember, a lot of the communities that were there early on were very passionate about militancy, you know, approaches, activist approaches towards government and government rule. So come down to 2021, 2022, I think there were a couple of disasters in the cryptocurrency sector that taught everybody a lot. So like FTX collapse, for example, was a big lesson for the industry. And for some regulators, they decided we're going to go with an outright ban. And other regulators decided we're going to try and regulate. Okay, so Singapore, for example, went in the direction of we'll try and regulate because they're very dependent on international flows. Dubai went in the side of let's try and regulate. Others said, like Morocco and Tunisia, outright ban. Now, if you look at what has worked and what has not worked, we now know that outright bans of cryptocurrencies and stablecoins don't work at all, right? So Tunisia and Morocco have banned, but they're almost like the 20th and the 21st in terms of adoption of these currencies because there are quite a number of digital workarounds. There's a nice paper done by a lady, I forget her name, but she was basically looking at, does heavy light enforcement, heavy, moderate, and light enforcement have any effect on adoption? And what she firmly established is there's no effect on adoption. The only effect you have is on the stablecoin premium. So how much are people willing to pay for US dollars, hard currency, versus how much they're willing to pay for USDT? So because people are adopting this thing the way they adopted Facebook and everything else, you just increase the price.
Yeah.
So like Nigeria took drastic actions in 2024 to deal with the currency devaluation challenge that they had, right? So remember, they had arrested
The guy from Binance.
The two guys from Binance executives. And they started coming after people. You know, if you had your LinkedIn or saying you're a crypto person.
Yeah, they will come for you. literally,
You know, it was a ridiculous one. But the funniest thing is, after taking those actions, 2024, 2025, 2026, if you look at the geography of crypto report released by Chainalysis, adoption actually tripled. So it moved from $30 billion to $95 billion. The only thing that they increased was the stablecoin premium, which means people were willing to pay much more to get into the stablecoins, about 22% to get into stablecoins. The only other higher country, Nigeria is the second one. The only other higher one is Argentina at 30%. If you look at countries that have very light enforcement, meaning they just let the market determine, market forces determine, likes of Thailand and Singapore and the rest of them, stablecoin premium is 0.5%.
Okay.
In places like Kenya, where we have moderate enforcement, it's 2%.
Okay.
So it's already clear that people are adopting these technologies. And so what is the best approach? The best approach is look at who the market players are and then regulate those market players to deal with issues like anti-money laundering and counter-terrorism financing.
Interesting. You know, in the last few years, I'm sure you've noticed it, there's a number of figures being thrown around, especially when it comes to the value of the market, the number of users, you know, what's being moved around.
Yes.
And I've always had the argument that most of the people that do the reports, it's based on the P2P transactions, in my view.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if, say, you are Felix, you have five addresses, they'll count that as five people. But in reality, it's one person. Then, about last year, there's a report that came out that Kenya was moving about, how much? It was a lot.
20 billion.
20 billion.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know how accurate those numbers are.
Yeah.
But given that probably you are the guy who's very deep into the industry, you might have a closer number. Can you give like an estimate of the figures around the use case, both on the consumer side, the business side, or even just the volume alone that you think could be moving in the market?
Yeah, so what I can personally attest to is, you know, I joined this industry when I was a young boy from university, now I'm a dad. And what I can personally attest to is the growth in volume overall. A lot of the people we started with, friends of mine, are now very wealthy tycoons like you.
Yeah, I'm not a tycoon.
Yes, but it's because there is more adoption. There is more people who know about this. Of course, adoption is mostly on the middle class and wealthy side. Okay, so if I was to do an estimate, the estimate will start there in middle class, upper middle class, the rich people who have massive businesses and they have dollar needs, or they probably are looking to hedge against inflation, or they're probably looking to do an investment kind of situation. So it's not widely adopted because, again, we have quite a number of challenges. Like look at the latest Oxfam report about Kenya's population. You say 48% of people live in extreme poverty.
Yeah.
That's not something you'll expect in a country like Kenya. It makes you feel like you live in a bubble, right? They say about 7 million people have gone back to poverty. It says 46% of people in urban areas like Nairobi walk to work.
46%?
46%. They can't afford, you know, a dollar or whatever to get on a matatu, right?
And Felix is here changing Range Rovers like it's nothing.
No, I'm not. But point here being that it's an asset which is focused on middle class.
Yeah.
And rich folks, the middle class, especially the young digital workers, people who have access to the internet, can pay for bundles and so on, are using it as a form of gig work payments.
Yeah,
so
true.
The guy is probably working for a guy in London, or he's probably doing digital marketing for somebody in Ukraine.
Yeah.
Somebody in Ukraine cannot pay you through the bank. Yeah. They're going to use USDT, USDC.
Yeah.
So if you look at that class of young, educated Kenyans who are working digital jobs because there are no new jobs locally, they are being paid by USDT. If you look at upper middle class, it's an investment. It's what do you call the, what would you say, the speculation.
Yeah.
Speculation trade, which is, I have some small money, I want it to multiply times six.
So I buy Bitcoin via USDT?
Yes, buy Bitcoin via USDT.
Yeah.
If you look at the rich people who have had businesses for years, for them it's more of managing their treasury. So I have a company that's in six African countries.
Yeah.
I can't hold all those currencies and they're moving all over the place.
Yeah.
So I'd rather park some of the funds in USDT and hold them in USDT. So those guys like to talk about treasury management a lot more. So if you were to take that 6 million figure, which is what has been touted around, my guess would be maybe 3 million, if we're being realistic.
So even on the volume around 20 billion, do you think that's on the higher side?
So I'm actually reading a paper by the IMF. So the IMF also tried to do their own estimates.
Mm.
It's just about the same, actually. It's not, it's about, I think it's 10 billion or so.
For, how much?
For Kenya, for 10 billion for Kenya.
$10 billion. Oh, for Kenya?
For Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
So what the IMF did was they took the blockchains, all blockchains, they started from the beginning, the Genesis block of Ethereum, Avalanche, etc.
Mm-hmm.
etc. They looked at domain names for Ethereum name service and the rest of them. So, you know, if you have your name there as Waidaka or +254, they know you probably come from this place. They looked at what kind of exchanges do you interact with. So if you interact with Binance, you're most likely from this place. If you interact with Coinbase, you're most likely from another place. They looked at daylight activity. So of course, if I look at time zones, I can tell this is within this particular period. And they're able to release this their first report on stablecoin volumes. They even were able to tell how much volume comes from China. Because you know, China stablecoin should be banned. But China accounts for a lot of the trading on chain.
Interesting, because I tend to think of a lot of the small businesses that do import export from China, would ideally use stable coins. Then would you say that a lot of this volume is on the business side or on the consumer side?
I would say it's on the business side. So 60% is 60% is institutional, meaning above $1 million. 30% is professional. So between $10,000 and $1 million, that's 30%. And then 6% is retail. 6% is what you see on P2P, you know, in Binance and other places. But a large percentage is institutional and retail for the very reasons that you have said, which is we have global trade, but the payment channels have not kept up with the times.
Okay. Interesting. Speaking of the payment side, I think USDT run by Tether has become the most common, widely used stablecoin, especially in emerging and frontier markets, especially for Kenya and Africa. You being a player in that space, you know, what do you think has led into this, you know, massive adoption of USDT in the region and especially in, you know, emerging economies like Kenya?
Yeah. And of course, your caveat being that we got an investment from Tether.
We are going into that.
So I'm not really selling them. But what I'll say is it's that thing they say about overnight success that takes 10 years.
Yeah.
Because if you're familiar with Tether's history, is that there was an early exchange called Bitfinex that started around 2017, 2018. Back then, they're not making any money from stablecoins because the Fed funds rate was like 0.5%. So if you pay the bank for keeping the treasury bills for you, you can even end up negative on the things you've parked there. I think as a business model, stablecoins as a business model really picked up when the Fed started raising rates to fight inflation. So if you remember the Biden years after COVID, inflation go to crazy levels, something like 9-10% inflation in the US, right? So the Fed had to raise rates, fight inflation. But in raising rates, they benefited bond buyers, essentially. And stablecoin issuers were holding mostly bonds. So it makes sense why they have made, you know, quite a lot of money from that. I think there's their strategy early on was to partner with, not to do everything by themselves.
Yeah.
So that really helped them. So yeah. their strategy was work with Binance,
yeah.
that's focused on the exchange side, yeah. Work with Tron and other blockchains that are more focused on the on the technology.
Okay.
And so if you are asking why is USDT so widely adopted in Africa, I think it was the first, if you remember the early days of Binance,
yeah.
it was the first option, USDT, and Tron was the first blockchain we yeah. choose actually. So if you can choose USDT, Tron. And for a very long time, Tron did not charge any fees. So it was
On the network side. Okay.
Literally no fees, like we were doing $0 for sending money across.
Yeah.
So adoption picked up and people have become comfortable with that reality. The trust has been established.
Okay.
I think the failure of Silicon Valley Bank and the depegging of USDC
yeah.
had an impact on people's belief in that particular asset class. Because you can say what you want to say, but by the end of the day, what is reality?
Yeah. Who gives me more liquidity?
so we have ended up with a lot more liquidity
mm-hmm.
For USDT on Tron.
Yeah.
But you can put other blockchains there. You can say Ethereum. All the other Ethereum L2s are trying.
Yeah.
Yeah. But if you're looking at LATAM, yeah. Southeast Asia and Africa, a lot of the liquidity is on USDT.
And then which is the most popular network?
Most popular network is still Tron.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So it's still Tron, then followed by Ethereum, then followed by Solana.
Okay.
In that order.
Interesting.
So if you look at Messari releases this data almost every day.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. As we come to an end of this, I mean, still want to speak on Tether and what they have done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they control 60% of the world's stablecoin, you know, market. You know, they are making investments left, right, and center, buying gold, US treasuries, and most importantly in the region, they just invested in you. The announcement was made, but they never announced how much.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to disclose how much?
Well, I can't say how much. I'll just say it was a strategic investment on their part.
Yeah.
Because of...
So ideally, they took a stake in Kotani.
They took a minority stake, although mm-hmm. significant in Kotani.
Mm-hmm.
So it's... we work together closely on that side.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, one of the things we liked about them, and why we went with them, was the fact that they were on the ground.
Yeah.
If you were to look at representation of Tether across emerging markets, they have a team that's spread in almost every country.
Yeah.
I think in Brazil, they have like two guys, because Brazil is really big.
Yeah.
Colombia, Ecuador, all those places.
Yeah.
Africa, they have chosen a team that even you know it's actually people you know.
Yeah, it's people that I've
interacted with,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And the same can be said with Southeast Asia.
Okay.
So in terms of their on-ground participation, it's been quite active.
Okay.
And then when they came in, they looked at market forces, they looked at the major players. They have not only invested in KotaniPay, they have also invested across the board.
Yeah, I've seen that.
So proving to be, like I said, their motto is not we do everything. Their motto is we work with people who are doing things well. And I think that has worked very well for them.
Okay, good. Thank you so much, Felix. This was a good conversation. Looking forward to the next one.
Asante, Eric.
Thank you, sir.
Shukuru.